Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Andrea Johnston of Retro Rockets, and we are going to be discussing Slan by A.E. Van Vogt, which was awarded the Retro Hugo Award for Best Novel in 2016 for the year 1941. So hi there, Andrea. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yes, the story of our internet friendship is I found out about your podcast. I reached out to you trying to invite you on here and you went, oh, I'd love to have you on my podcast. So you got the jump on me.
You reached out right as the podcast was starting.
Yeah.
So we were lining up lots of interviews and you didn't know it at the time, but you were already on my list.
Oh, sweet. Well, yeah. So you beat me by, I don't know, a year. Or so.
No. Hey, a couple months.
Okay. But anyway, why don't you start by talking about Retro Rockets? What are you doing?
So Retro Rockets is my new podcast. We're going to turn 1 year old in February. Okay. And it's vintage science fiction, sci fantasy. And I have a sneaky suspicion that in year 2023, we're going to be talking about all sorts of different things, not just classic science fiction.
All right. And you do a variety of, I mean, you had me on, you've had authors on, you know, people who actually know what they're talking about, which is cool.
We've had a lot of fun. I got really lucky. I ran a blog for a number of years, so I had a lot of connections through that. And my producer, Andy Robbins, has a lot of connections through local bookstores, book clubs, relationships that he has. So we got very, very lucky and very fortunate.
Very cool. What about your history as a science fiction fan?
I was one of those kids that watched every single outer space show and every single astronomy show on PBS, Nova, Cosmos. If it had outer space, if it had the solar system, my butt was planted in front of the television, and I was all about astronomy all the time.
Nice. So my personal history with Slan, this is one of the rare rereads on the list because I had only read 12 when I started doing this. And I read this because essentially Harlan Ellison told me that I was not a real science fiction fan because I liked Star Trek novels.
Wait, say what?
So there's a famous, I'm exaggerating just a little bit. There's a famous episode of the Sci-Fi Vortex. It used to be on the Sci-Fi Channel, and they'd have on like J. Michael Straczynski, and you know, I think they had Gene Wolfe, I think maybe they were both on that episode with Harlan Ellison, and they were talking about the difference between science fiction and sci-fi. And they're talking about the word sci-fi was always to them like an insult. It's just sci-fi. And so he was comparing things like the original Alien to Aliens, where he said Alien is science fiction, Aliens is sci-fi. Now, I love both of them. So
I love both of them, but I can buy into that sentence.
Yeah, it's like when you say, oh, that's a movie, that's a film, right? It gets a little elitist sometimes when you think about it that way. But he was lamenting essentially about the fact that there are people who consider themselves science fiction fans, but you know, they're reading Star Trek novels. And he said, they're reading Star Trek novels and they've never read anything by A.E. Van Vogt. And so I went, well, you know, I like me some Star Trek novels. I like other science fiction as well. But that set me on A.E. Van Vogt. I looked him up.
Like A.E. Van Vogt specifically?
He said A.E. Van Vogt specifically. He also mentioned The Demolished Man, which was the first winner of the Hugo Award. Mm-hmm. So I just, you know, I searched A.E. Van Vogt, found his first and most famous novel, Slan, and read it. So, and it was years ago. I don't remember how long ago that was, but yes, that's how I discovered this book. So I wanted to ask you about it. Well, you know, what's your history?
Yeah, I want to come back to the Star Trek thing because I'm laughing a little bit. Slan is not a fix-up novel, but some of my other favorite Van Vogts are fix-up novels where they were serialized short stories and then smashed together in a novel. But when you read them, like I'm talking about like Mission to the Stars, Voyage of the Space Beagle, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. When you read them, they feel very episodic.
Yeah.
Star Trek is episodic. Mm-hmm. So that he referenced like Star Trek specifically is making me laugh a little bit.
Yes. I mean, this one was originally published in Astounding, but it was
serialized.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, you know, I sort of think of a fix-up as something that started off serialized and then was pushed into a novel, but it is possible to serialize a novel without it ending up being a fix-up later.
And like my experience with fix-up novels is they're not so much serialized as it's a planned story.
Yes.
It'll be a bunch of short stories that either take place in the same universe mm-hmm. or can be smushed together and give that impression.
Right, right. Like the Foundation, the first couple Foundation books really
exactly.
feel that way. And if yep. you go back and read like H.P. Lovecraft, we were reading one of his for Take Me to Your Reader at some point, and like the beginning of each chapter seemed to recap what happened in the previous one. We're like, this is because it was coming out serially.
And, yep.
And so there are markers of a fix-up novel. So yeah, Slan for you. It sounds like you have more experience with A.E. Van Vogt.
And I was itchy to read more. Hmm. So it's, I was going through some of my old book reviews because I knew I had read a bunch of A.E. and Van Vogt, but I couldn't remember when. Hmm. And it was, 2012, 2010, 2015. So it's been a handful of years.
Okay. And I mean, just kind of to circle back to talk more a little about your history, how did you come? You said you enjoyed science fiction television, that kind of stuff. How did you connect to vintage science fiction?
So in 2010, I started a blog, Little Red Reviewer. It was just a way for me to keep track of stuff that I was reading. I didn't really have any plans for it. I'd always read some vintage sci-fi, like read a lot of Isaac Asimov, read some Heinlein. Just it was what my parents had on the shelf, what I could find at the library. There was no plan.
Okay.
But as I was reading more science fiction from the 70s and 80s and 90s, it was, hey, where'd all this stuff come from?
Sure.
And I found myself really fascinated with, the authors, the contemporary authors that I really like, who inspired them? Mm. Who were they reading? Who was that person reading? I remember reading an interview, this had to have been 10 years ago, reading an interview with Scott Lynch, where he said he was inspired by Fritz Leiber. Mm. Well, I went and got myself a whole bunch of Fritz Leiber books, nice. And I could see the connections. Mm. And that was really fun. So sometime in, 2012, 2013, reading challenges were all the rage with blogs, or at least in the circles that I was in, it was all the rage, fill out, complete a bingo card and read 7 books in a month. And I just could not do that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I still wanted to, I still wanted to do something cool. So I started the Vintage Sci-Fi Month Not a Challenge.
Right.
And it was read a book if you want, lurk if you want, read a bunch of books if you want.
Right.
And it kept me out of trouble and it took off.
Nice.
But anyway, Slan.
Yeah, yeah. One of the other funny things I wanted to mention was, and it's a connection to Take Me to Your Reader, my other podcast, is that the very first episode we recorded, and we recorded it 3 times because we were terrible. we didn't know how to use microphones. We didn't know how to edit. We didn't know how to really structure a conversation. But the first podcast that we did was on The Day the Earth Stood Still, which is based on a short story called Farewell to the Master by Harry Bates. And it happens that it was published in Astounding Science Fiction in October of 1941, which the cover image on that edition was for Slan. So I thought that was cool.
That is a cool connection. I like that a lot.
Yeah. Did you want to talk about, have you read many other Hugo Award winners? Did you happen to tally them up?
I tallied them up. I might have miscounted, but I think it was around 32.
Okay. Nice. Nice. And this is where I say at this point, it feels like bragging to say I'm at 72. This one didn't add to my tally because I'd already read it. But
72. That is some bragging rights. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it really puts a fine point on the fact that I'm getting toward the end of the list. And it also makes the question about why did we pick this book a little redundant, because you're like, well, there were 5 things to pick from.
And I was looking through some of the other books and it was, I know I have a copy of that. I know I have a copy of that. And about halfway through reading Slan, I found my copy of one of the other books on the list. Slan just happened to be the first one on my bookshelf that I found.
Wow. So at this point, we usually start diving into non-spoiler discussion of the book, talk about, general impressions of it, maybe talk about the quick synopsis or quick non-spoiler synopsis of it. Do you want to tackle that?
I'd be happy to tackle a non-spoilery synopsis, kind of summarizing the back of the book. So our main character is Jomi, and he is a Slan, which means he can read minds, and he has super strength, and he's super fast. And when he's 9 or 10 years old, his parents are killed. he actually witnesses his mom being killed. This is not a spoiler. That happens like 15 pages in.
Right.
So he's an orphan. He needs to find a place to stay safe. And he wants to, he knows his father had a secret project, but he doesn't know what it was. So he's trying to stay alive. He doesn't want to starve to death. He's trying to learn about his father's secret project. And in this far future Earth, everybody hates Slans, and it's totally okay to shoot them on sight. So
right.
He has to stay in hiding.
Yeah, and I think in terms of non-spoilers, that'll probably do it, right? It's worth mentioning probably that Slans are telepathic. They are kind of superhuman as well.
Yes.
In fact, they have different physiology.
They do. Like he has to wear his. They have two hearts. He has to either wear his hair very long or wear a hat, because true Slans have these tendrils that come out of their head. Like I don't know if they're little antenna or what.
I was trying to picture them, and I don't really have Are they just like spaghetti, or do they look like little mushrooms?
I was envisioning like some kind of like anime character with like little. You know, something. Because this is a podcast, you can't see that I've got like my hands up on my head looking all silly. Yeah.
Well, it does mention that they're out the back of their heads.
Why did I think it was like on the on the front of their heads? I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe A. Van Vogt really just liked the mullet hairstyle.
But we do have, this isn't really in spoiler territory yet,
no.
But we do have Slans that do not have the tendrils.
Yes.
And they kind of have their own agenda, and they're doing their own thing. This is very much, I wasn't sure what to expect. I didn't know if this was going to be a story about people. I didn't know if this was going to be a story about technology, about science. It's
right.
Very much about different groups of people having their own agenda.
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. And the agendas being at odds. And then you have someone like, I say Jami, just because that's, that's the way the audiobook says it. And I think it says his name is actually John.
Yes. Right at the end. He's like John Michael. So yes, it would be Jami. And then I kind of thought about it, like that is like his mom gave him such a super cute nickname if his full name is John Michael.
Yes. And he's kind of in the middle because he doesn't know any of the politics.
No.
And so he's trying to figure out, is there a solution to this that will allow for the smallest amount of bloodshed and I can bring everyone together? But he's at odds with both the tendrilists organization and the humans.
Oh, he's such an idealist. Like we first meet him, he's 9 or 10 years old. Then there's a time jump and he's around 15, 16 ish. Mm-hmm. And then there's a time jump again and he's in kind of his early 20s. And he witnesses so much awful stuff, but he's still an idealist throughout the whole story.
Yeah. And if there's something that carries over from the serialization, those time jumps do kind of, I'm not sure if they are structured along that. I didn't read it in the magazine format, so I don't know.
Oh, that would make a lot of sense if that's where the serialization splits are.
Mm-hmm. It's possible. I'm not sure. There are more than one edition of the book because it came out originally in serialization and then was turned into a bound novel. And then there's a 1951.
Which version I have?
You can probably find it in the title page. It's probably the 1951. I think there was a slightly revised edition from 51.
Yes, this is the 1951 version, but printed in 1968.
Okay. Yeah. And, I had the ebook and the text was evidently from an earlier time. I didn't look at the title page.
I wonder what differences there are.
I'll tell you about a couple of them as we go, because I found it pretty interesting, because I did what I often do, where I read the book in print and listened to the audiobook, and just, I'd get ahead of myself in the audiobook, and then I'd catch up with the novel, and it makes it so that the differences really do stand out. Sometimes it's just that, I guess I was zoned out and I didn't catch that while I was in the audiobook, or, I was driving someplace and distracted. But this time I went, now that did not happen in the version that I have.
Now you have to tell me what differences did you come across?
I think we should get to that in spoilers.
Got it.
Because there's definitely some different character motivations that you're like, oh, okay, that guy was a real scumbag here. And here there's a little redemption for him.
Yes, that is a spoiler because just a scumbag character. I think I know exactly who you're talking about.
It's a very minor one from pretty early in the book.
Yeah.
Can you think of anything in terms of comps for the book? I usually like to, you know, throw that out there.
I was thinking about this earlier today, and I don't know if you're familiar with the writer Stephanie Salter, I think is her last name. She's a British writer. She wrote a trilogy 6 or 8 years ago. I think it was called the Regeneration Trilogy. And Slan reminded me of that book because in that, it's a trilogy, in that series, there's a whole group of humanity that is, you know, you're different, we're afraid of you, we don't understand you, you've got, you know, powers that we don't understand, we're going to segregate you, and if you make us mad, we're going to kill you.
Right.
And that trilogy very much becomes an us versus them kind of story. With, you know, all sorts of twists and turns, and just Slan being an us versus them story reminded me of that.
Yeah.
And it's also got some really fantastic action scenes.
It does, yeah.
So if you like action movies, I don't know why I thought of it, but I was like, hey, some of these action scenes remind me of the Bourne Identity movies.
Sure.
So if that's your style of action, then you might like Slan.
Yeah, there's definitely a an adaptation of this that where you could go the action route.
Yeah.
And that would be interesting because I think you mentioned early on when you were reading it, I just started reading. It's very exciting at the beginning. And it really is. That opening part is very cinematic.
Cinematic is the perfect word. And I wouldn't categorize Slan as an action thriller, but it does have very cinematic action scenes.
Yeah, yeah. It's anytime you have a mutation where people are discriminated against, you're going to think X-Men. Mm-hmm. The Broken Earth series has a similar thing where you have the origins who are feared and shunned as well. But that's about it for me for comps. So overall thoughts on this one? What did you think? It's a first time read for you.
Overall, I really liked it.
Okay.
Now that I've learned that it was serialized, that some of the weird jumps make a lot more sense.
Yeah.
We'll get to it in spoilers, but some stuff that happened in the end was just very, very surprising for me.
Yeah.
I liked this story about this little orphaned boy who has to figure things out. Mm-hmm. And he ends up living with this cranky, drunk old lady, and they just absolutely hate each other.
Yes.
But he saves her life, and she saves his life. Mm. And their dynamic was very progressive for 1940.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, one other comp that I just thought of is Firestarter.
Because
there's a climactic scene at a farm where the bad guys catch up to him.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a little spoilery, but I enjoyed this one as well. And it is a reread for me. I had forgotten most of it.
Okay.
I remembered the twist about Keir Gray, and we'll get to that in spoilers. I remembered that there were tenderless Slans, but I didn't remember that there was the big organization.
Yes.
I remembered some of the ridiculous 40s era science parts of it, you know, the 10-point steel thing.
Did any of that make any sense to you? Because it didn't make any sense to me.
No. And if you like hard science fiction, this is not
it. This is like the original soft sci-fi.
Yes. And there's a point
sci-fi.
Late in the book, there's a point where Jami is explaining to Keir Gray his father's discoveries about atomic energy.
That made no
and
sense
it's
to me at
just
all.
Absolute babble.
You know what it is? It is Star Trek technobabble.
It is technobabble. It is classic technobabble. Yes. Yeah. And so I remembered some of that, but that was basically it. And I remembered the beginning of it. And so actually at some point I went, did I really read this book, or did I, you know, as soon as it went off track and I went, oh, I don't remember any of this. I wondered if I had actually read it, or if I had read maybe Slan Hunter, which is the sort of long awaited sequel that was co-written by Kevin J. Anderson.
Or, maybe you read the first 20 pages of this book, got distracted, put it down, didn't come back to it. That happens to me a lot.
Yeah, no, I definitely did finish it. I have it in my book tracker. I made myself a database where I can track my reading, and I blogged about it at some point.
We're the best kind of nerds.
Yeah, exactly. overall, I still really do enjoy this book. And I, like you mentioned, I think there's a couple points where it's a little progressive for being written in the late 30s, you know, early 40s.
Yeah. There's a character we meet at the beginning, Kathleen, and there's a scene where, is she going to be put in a really terrible situation or not?
Yeah.
And basically it's Kathleen, what do you want to do?
Yeah.
And, you know, she's 17 or 18 years old, and a whole bunch of adults are giving her agency of, you know, if you want to do this thing, you can. But if you don't feel like doing that, you don't have to. When was the last time you read a woman with agency in 1940?
Right, right. Or, you know, read about a woman without having detailed descriptions of her body, right? And this book does a better job, I feel like, than most, where Hugo Girl, the ladies of Hugo Girl, I'm not going to have boob talk to talk about in this one. It does keep mentioning Kathleen's slim body.
But that's about it.
Yeah, that's about it. And so I feel like the female characters have a little more respect to them in this.
And it's, I don't know, in my mind, I'm like, okay, when you meet her, she's a teenager. I can buy into a teenager being skinny.
Sure. But she's also strong and she gets to show it off in at least one place.
Yes. And she does not take any crap from anybody. I was waiting for her to just punch people in the face.
Yes. Yeah. And I would definitely want to circle back to that in spoilers. But kind of rounding up my overall thoughts, there's some of the action scenes I really enjoy, and other ones I feel like there's a vagueness to them where I can't quite picture what's going on.
Yes. There's one at the end.
Yes.
Where it's very exciting, very cinematic, but I had to read it a couple of times because there's obvious gaps in what's happening.
Yeah. And I also wonder if this book really plays fair with the reader. And that is definitely for spoilers.
You have to talk more about that.
Yeah. 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 So, spoiler time?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's do it. So, right. I mean, it's a recommend, I think, from both of us.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's a book from 1940. I don't feel bad spoiling it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So spoilers, we do have, I did not remember that Kathleen existed as a character in the book. And she gets, it kind of alternates between Jami and Kathleen at the beginning. And this is where we get some of the differences between the additions.
Oh, do tell.
Yeah.
Because there's that creepy guy at the beginning.
Davy Dinsmore.
No. There's an adult guy.
Oh, Jem Laurie.
Yeah.
Who wants to marry her. Who wants to take her as his mistress.
Right. Which I think he's married to somebody else.
Yes. I think so.
He's a jerk. And then, but Davy, is.
So Davy is the younger version, essentially, of Jem Laurie. And I feel like in a subsequent edition, maybe somebody said, that's a little redundant to have Davy creeping on her and then have Jem Laurie creeping on her. Mm-hmm. Because there's a point in the edition that I read where Davy grabs her by the tendrils and forces her to kiss him. And I don't think that's in the 1951 version.
No, I don't have that sentence.
Yeah.
And he eventually, like Davy does eventually redeem himself.
Yes. And in the updated version of it, he's a little nicer to her. She actually likes him. Where in the original version of it, she didn't like him at all. None of his advances were welcome. So I feel like that was cleaned up to make it so, hey, let's have one loathsome character and have it be Jem Laurie.
Right. Because Kathleen and Davy had been, you know, childhood acquaintances.
Yes.
And then suddenly he's very mean to her and she doesn't understand why. It's
right, and it's for a purpose.
It is for a purpose. Yeah. And I mean, you find out later. So I never felt he was creeping on her. It was just this version. Yeah.
None of the stuff about him being mean to her to save her life.
Yes.
Is in the original version. Mm-hmm. That's only in the updated version. And so
do you know why they made the change?
Like I said, if I'm trying to put on my analysis hat and figure that out, I feel like it's because they wanted Jem Laurie to be the loathsome one.
Yeah.
And so we need to tone it down a little bit for Davy.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And it's weird. She's like trapped, she's not trapped in the, I guess it'd be like the presidential palace or whatever, but she's not really allowed to leave. Mm-hmm. And she's stuck there for her safety. And I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah.
But let's talk about some really juicy spoilers, like at the end.
Yeah, I want to talk more about let's stay at the toward the beginning, right?
Because
you have that exciting scene where Jami's mother is with him, and then they split up because she realizes they're going to be caught, mm-hmm. and she can buy him some time. Mm-hmm. And this is where we get one of those kind of vague action scenes where he's fleeing from people. And there's one hilariously 1940s thing where he ends up going through like an apartment complex or something and gets accosted by some women. And it makes a editorial aside that, you know, or not an editorial aside, like he thinks, well, it's a good thing it was during the workday, so none of the men were home.
He's in a tenement, and then he's in an alley, yeah. and I kind of envision him like digging through all the trash in this alley and finding this tunnel that had been, you know, dug through some fencing or something.
Yeah, he ends up being able to hide from the mob.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. But Granny knows where he is, and Granny's smart. And Granny is an interesting character, right? Because she sees Jami and she sees the idea of profit, but she sees it as more of, you know, some people would capture him and turn him into the secret police and hopefully get paid for that.
Oh, but she's wants smarter more. Than that. She knows how to use him. And they have this very strange dynamic that, you know, she puts a roof over his head. And keeps him fed and keeps him safe and keeps him alive and still gives him some freedom. Yeah. But he's working for her now.
Yeah. You're gonna be a mule for me. You're gonna steal for me. And
you're gonna read people's minds and see what they're thinking, and you're gonna help me find those marks.
Yeah. And so they're able to improve their situation because he goes to rob a shopping center of some kind. And gets distracted because he finds a Slan, and then realizes this Slan can't read his mind, and he follows them to the air center.
Oh yes,
and realizes this is where he discovers the Tenderless organization. They seem to have space flight, and this is one of those hilarious 1940s thing where he's writing this book before radar has been discovered, and so the idea of being able to detect an aircraft with anything but visual or audio. Does not enter this
hear
book.
These you get the impression that they're very large, very loud, kind of low Earth orbit type things. Did nobody hear them taking off?
Yeah, I don't know. it's not hard science fiction, I guess.
No.
But you know, he burns a bunch of time then trying to escape from them. And there's some cool scenes of him, like climbing down the outside of a building because his hands are strong enough that he can do that.
Yeah.
And so then when he's going back through the shopping center to try to steal some stuff, he hears from somebody that there's a bunch of money in a bank. And I love that he's smart enough that he doesn't tell Granny the real number. Because the man is thinking there's $400,000 or something in a safe, and he tells her there's $4,000. because giving her too much would have been bad.
Yes, and he's old enough that he understands. You know, when Granny first rescues him, he's 9 or 10 years old, and I think by
but
the
he's
time,
precocious.
Very, but you know, she learns how to use him, and he learns how to use her. It's kind of dark.
It is. Yeah. And you know, he keeps getting little hints that, oh, she's thinking about betraying me again.
Again.
Yeah. And so he'll have to call her out and go, no, don't. I'm leaving today. So never mind about betraying me. And by the way, if you turned me in, they would just execute you for harboring me. So, you know, don't do that.
They've entrapped each other.
Yeah. And so he ends up with enough money to send her with a little bit of seed money to set up a place for him to hide out after he goes on his mission to try to find something that his father's left for him. And finds this disintegration weapon, you know, horrifically kills a few people. They did have it coming.
They did. I wonder if he knew what the gun would do.
No, it says that he didn't, right? He was surprised by it.
Yeah.
You know, there's no introspection about the fact that he had just completely disintegrated three people, but
they deserved it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he could read their minds. He knew what they were going to do. So once he hides out with Granny, then he starts setting about his plans to get back into that space center and find out what's the deal with the Tenderless. And I can't remember if they come for him before then at the farm. Now I'm getting the
I know it's chronology either, mixed it's up. Either the Tenderless that come for him at the farm or the humans,
the secret police.
Somebody comes for him. everybody's after everybody else. Nobody trusts right. anybody else. The tendrilists want to kill the humans. The humans want to kill any kind of slans. The true slans just want to live in peace and not die. So everybody's after everybody else. And he's got these wonderful defenses in the farm. I remember this very, very quick little scene where it's a farm in a valley somewheres. And other people live in the valley, other farmers. And he has telepathically kind of implanted a thought in these people's minds. They don't know it. That if they see or hear an airplane, they will telepathically shout.
Yeah, they'll notice it loudly.
Exactly. Yes, very much so. They'll be like, "Oh my gosh, there's a plane!" So they're his patrol.
Yeah, they're his canary in the coal mine.
Exactly, exactly.
And so that extends the range.
Yeah, and you know, he's got all this cool machinery, like in his basement, and it mentions like counters full of knobs and computers everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
And screens everywhere. That was really fun.
Yes, yes.
It was ridiculous, but fun.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's great. You just picture like Sulu's console from the original Star Trek.
Yes.
And one of the things that this book does is it will just suddenly drop something in that you're evidently supposed to know about. Like it says that he'd been working on his crystal hypnosis.
His what?
Yeah, this was not established at any point, but it turns out that he can use some kind of crystals to hypnotize people and to change their minds. And that's what he had done in the valley, right? Where he had used that to work on Granny's baser instincts and to make her a little more kinder and a gentler Granny.
Yeah, yeah. She was mean.
yeah, she was. But yeah, it's there's implications of brainwashing that I feel like this is not necessarily a thing heroes do.
I mean, take someone who is an idealist and have everyone out to kill that person.
Yeah.
What kind of hero are you building?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that's where it reminds me of Firestarter as well, because the main character's father has this mental domination power where he can get people to do what he wants them to do at a cost to himself, where Jami doesn't really have any cost to himself other than the time that it takes to use the crystals and do it. And then he finds out he can do it without the crystals as well.
But you're right. He doesn't pay any kind of cost. It's
no,
you know, it's magic that's free.
Yeah. So through this, he eventually finds Kathleen, because Kathleen has to escape. She has to make her escape. And this is the thing about her we didn't really mention, is that she's under the protection of the dictator, the leader of Earth, Keir Gray, who is apparently violently anti-Slan and is in charge of all the policies for hunting down Slans. But he's been protecting Kathleen. Mm-hmm. And because at the beginning of the book, she's getting like towards her 11th birthday.
And he's like protecting her for scientific purposes,
to have a
live slan to study.
Yes, yeah.
So yes, we have Keir Gray, who hates slans and is very very much promotes a policy of shoot them on sight.
Right.
Except for Kathleen, who I'm protecting. But if you see, even if you suspect somebody of being a slan, you know, arrest them, get rid of them. I hate them.
Yes. Yeah. And John Petty, his right-hand man, head of the secret police, is very, very hyper to execute Kathleen as soon as possible.
They fight over it all the time, the two of them.
Yeah. And this is where Keir uses Kathleen to read people's minds, to find out who's on my side in my inner circle. And it's a pretty horrifying coup where he brings in essentially the lieutenants of all these people and has them, okay, you shoot your boss and then, you know, you're on the council. Congratulations on your promotion.
And they're all like, sweet, that's awesome. And I remember there's a scene where he kind of real quickly tells Kathleen, you know, you're going to read people's minds for me, but go sit in the corner where no one can see you, and I'll have everybody facing away from you so that they forget that you're in the room.
Yeah, that's good stuff. And and then it's sort of repeated later where now Kathleen is older and she is caught looking through Keir Gray's stuff. And he has to basically say, you know, go to your room, pack your things, you're out of here. And that's her opportunity to escape. Yep. And that's I'm sure what he's intending. And so that's where you finally get Kathleen and Jami to meet.
But they meet, and it's, you know, finally for the two of them, they're finally each finding a true Slan who is their age. And Kathleen, yes. I don't think has ever met another Slan before.
Right, right. And she's a little older than he is. Yeah. I think she's 3 or 4 years older.
Yes, yes.
But, and I can't remember if this is in the voice of one of the characters. I think it is. To find kindred at last is a special joy. It yes. says. And this is where I think it's probably a good idea to talk about the, have you ever heard of Fans or Slans?
No.
So this was a sort of a reaction to this book talking about fandom mm-hmm. and how there's an elitism angle to it, right? Fans of science fiction are especially intelligent and smart and
yes,
special.
Yes, we are.
I hear you saying that with tongue in cheek, right? I assume.
Yes.
Not that we're not special, but you know the idea that somehow science fiction fans are smarter than everybody else and that kind of stuff.
Well,
because
we study yeah. science, obviously.
Yeah, but there are plenty of people who don't like science fiction who are, you know, great.
Yes.
But the good part about it is the where I see the fans or slans thing is when you find your people.
Oh,
it's really
you know,
special.
It was yeah. The first time I went to a science fiction convention.
Hmm.
I knew like 3 people there. There's probably a good 1,200 people there.
Yeah.
And I realized I had found my tribe.
Mm-hmm. Or if like, you know, for me, like if I'm wearing a shirt that has a geeky print on it, like this one has 42 on it, right? People are going to be like, oh, life, the universe and everything, you know? And I'm like, yes, you are my people. I even noticed it... I went down to Texas to visit my son and to catch a Seattle Mariners game where they were playing the Houston Astros
yeah.
in Houston. And so we got that experience of every time we'd pass somebody else wearing Mariners gear, we'd be like, yeah, hey, you know, what's up? you know, high fives. They lost the game, but it was still cool to yeah. be like, hey, some of my people are here. So I think, yeah, I think there's a healthy part of that fans or slans idea and maybe an unhealthy part of the elitism part of it.
But it's nice to hang out with people who understand your nerdiness, you know,
yes.
who understand your passion. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, sure, not all sci-fi fans are into the same thing, but
exactly.
but we all had that experience where, you know, schoolmates said, "You read what?"
Yeah.
So to just find someone who's had that experience is mm-hmm. it's wonderful.
Yeah, there's some commonality, I feel like, to the nerdy experience.
Yes.
Where you're like, okay,
yes.
we haven't experienced all the same things, but categories of things, yes.
Mm-hmm. And Jami and Kathleen don't get a whole ton of time together.
No, they don't. And they're immediately, yeah. you know.
Like the valley is like immediately attacked.
Yes, but also like it's love at first sight as well.
Oh, yes.
And it makes sense, a certain sense, right? If you could truly know someone the way you could. I mean, you would essentially immediately know, okay, yep, we're good.
did you ever watch Babylon 5?
Just a couple of episodes.
Okay. I forget if...
I know there were telepaths in there because Walter Koenig,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And he's got some other folks that work for him, and there's a blonde actress. I always really liked her. People didn't seem to much care for her, but I liked her. And part of her backstory is she's had romantic relationships with other telepaths.
Okay.
And, you know, there's no, in Babylon 5, there's no rules about, you know, who
sure.
a telepath can date. It's do whatever you want. But there's all these conversations of that when two telepaths are romantically entangled, it is entirely different.
Yeah.
You always know what the other person's thinking. You never have to guess what the other person needs.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what Kathleen and Jami have.
Yes. But then they're immediately separated because she is killed by John Petty, who randomly shows up. And, you know, credit where it's due. He didn't monologue. He just blew her away. It's a horrible thing to do, but...
I was really shocked by that scene.
I was too. I did not remember that.
Yeah. I did not expect that at all. I remember I was reading and I got to that scene and I get a couple of sentences later and it's like, wait a minute, what? And I had to go back and reread it.
Yeah, I wrote down here, well, crap, if Kathleen was killed. and I said, I want to complain that she was fridged, but on the other hand, villains so rarely act decisively, I have to hand it to him.
And you're right, he didn't monologue, he wasn't vengeful, he just walked in and shot her in the head.
Yeah.
And then that was it. And it's...
Yeah, this is the point where he flees to the, it says the West Coast, where he has had Granny go ahead and it's like, I'll bring the rest of your money when I come to you. You establish a farm there.
I wondered if, you know, he meets Kathleen and he loses Kathleen. Like, my first thought was, is this where Jami becomes an evil bad guy?
Right.
Because he had a moment of true love and then she's torn away.
Mm-hmm.
And is he just going to snap and start killing everybody?
Right. Yeah. But he stays empathetic, you know, he stays noble. And there's even when he finally does infiltrate the space center and steals the rocket, it turns out it's not unmanned, right? There's
like a woman on board.
Yeah. And her name is, I did write it down. No, it's Joanna. I don't know
Joanna,
what I'm talking about.
Joanna,
and she's a tenderless land. She's on the ship. And so she holds him up and they have a discussion. And at some point she realizes that he truly is not as antagonistic as she expected him to be as a true Slan. And that's where you have these layers of propaganda throughout the years, from the humans, anti-Slan, from the tenderless lands, anti-Slan, like everybody is against the true Slans. But at some point she is kind of smitten with him and is like, well, I mean, who else are you going to marry? And he says, look, even if I wanted to marry you, you know, I got a mission. And that's as hard as he gets, right? That he's like, no, forget about feelings. I got to fulfill my mission. I have to find the true Slans
he gets very focused.
Yeah. And this is where he ends up visiting Mars, and that's where the tenderless Slans have set themselves up. And he infiltrates that. And it's kind of funny that he finds out that there was like an APB put out on people who look like Jami.
Yes. And it's
similar body and facial types.
And I'm like, are all these people clones of each other, that people could look so, so similar that they're just going to arrest anybody that looks like him?
Right, right. It's I guess A.E. Van Vogt was way ahead of time on racial profiling or something. I mean, it's literal profiling, right? Because people who look like him.
You know, a certain hair color, certain shape of your ears, a certain shape of your chin, certain hairstyle.
Yeah. And so he finds out that one of the people who looks like him happens to have... His wife had a dreadful head injury and she's recovering in a hospital. And so...
Oh, yeah. Doesn't he pretend to be the husband? And they're like, oh, you know, the wife is going to wake up and she'll know immediately that you're not her husband. And he's like, I'm willing to take that risk or something.
It goes sideways right off the bat because essentially he's like, okay, I can do this. I can incapacitate this guy, impersonate him, get to Mars. And they're like, hey, you're 20 minutes late, dude, or 5 minutes late. So we think you might be Jami Cross. So you're going to have to go through some physical things. And so he's figured out how to hide his tendrils by putting artificial hair on that is bound onto him well enough that they can grab him by the hair and hold him in the air, which is kind of fun. And then, there's the crucial thing where when you go in to see this woman, she's going to wake up and she's going to recognize that it's not you. But then it's another credit to Jami that in the course of him investigating what's going on with her, he realizes that he can help her recover. And so he does, using his abilities while staying out of the, I guess, the mind. They have some mind reading tech called Porgrave.
Is that what readers? That is?
Okay. Because there's Porgrave projectors and Porgrave readers,
and he's able to block that stuff from knowing who he is.
Yeah, he can kind of sculpt his thoughts to seem like they would be normal thoughts of a person in his situation with his wife there recovering from this injury.
The end of this is so fast paced compared to like the first 100 pages.
Yeah, and that's where I feel like some of this. You could have made this a 300-page novel, and some of this stuff could have been a little better developed. And instead of just dropping in, there's Porgrave projectors. I've never heard of them before, but there they are. And readers.
I wonder if, this was serialized. I wonder if at first he didn't know how many parts it was going to be. And then perhaps an editor said, hey, wrap it up. I don't have room for you.
By the way, we said 5 parts. Now we're going to do 4.
I got 4. Just like Babylon 5.
It absolutely could be because some of it goes kind of just hand over fist. Yeah. He gets pulled out of trouble by Joanna, though, when he's on Mars before they can get to the physical examination that he will definitely not pass.
He will spectacularly fail that.
And she has at some point also uncovered material that says, hey, whatever the guy's name was, Samuel Lan.
Oh,
the inventor of the Slans, right? Where the story goes that he had used some kind of mutation machinery to create the first Slans.
Yeah, he used the machine on his wife to,
right,
you know, change the baby's genetics or something.
Right. And then humans believe that Slans manipulate and create other Slans, right?
Right, they there's this whole
experiment
thing
on people.
Yeah, there's this whole thing at the beginning of, you know what Slans do to human babies, don't you? And I'm like, no, I don't. Tell me.
I mean, it's just kind of layered in there.
Yes.
But it turns out that, no, they're just natural mutations. Yep. And so a certain number of pregnancies result in a Slan baby just naturally.
And all Samuel Lan did was identified these mutated babies, and this is kind of gross, but he crossbred siblings.
Yes.
To get more mutated babies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it breeds true as well. And so this is where he finds out essentially, no, the tenderless Slans, or no, the true Slans did not do any experiment on people. It's just a natural mutation. So all those stories are not true. And that's good information for him to have. And then he makes it back to Earth. And this whole time he's been wanting to find Kier Gray and kill him, because he's the enemy of the Slans. And so this is where he gets back there, breaks into the palace, gets trapped.
And Kier's like, hey, how are you?
Yeah, didn't think you'd get trapped that easily, but yeah, sit down and let me give you the huge exposition.
Yes,
about now.
Yes.
And this is where there's a lot of technobabble, and it's kind of, well, this is a lot of information to put here at the end of the book. And then the book ends.
Well, I mean, it makes sense that it is right at the end, because we're all so invested. Imagine if that kind of info dump had been at the beginning. You'd have just fallen right out of the story. At this point, we're invested. We've lost Kathleen. We've met Joanna. We've been to Mars. We've met the true Slans. We've learned about Samuel Lan. We're invested. If you're going to put that info dump anywheres, put it there.
Sure. So this is the part where I hinted at earlier. I'm not sure it plays fair, because you find out that Kier Gray is a true Slan, but he doesn't have any tendrils. He's apparently been able to pass physical examination. So I don't know in what way he's a true Slan, but he insists that he is. Other than perhaps, you know, when he goes through the history of things and says, look, we bioengineered ourselves to suppress the tendrils for some generations, with the expectation that at some point we'd start breeding.
At some point they'll come back, right.
Yeah, they'd come back. Mm-hmm. So, I still have to think of Kier Gray as a tenderless Slan, even though it never mentions him as such. And he is the father of Kathleen, who is, of course, still alive, because they have that brain repair technology.
Yes, I mean, he's like the dictator of Earth, so he can say, you know, yeah, I'll take that test tomorrow, or how dare you question me? Like, is anybody really going to question him? Of course they won't.
Sure. Yeah. And he talked about how he had surrounded himself with some other, you know, Slans who had infiltrated the palace and conducted some political assassinations to suppress certain things.
So he surrounded himself with idiots on purpose, because they're never going to question him, or he's just so dominant that he's going to mow right over them.
Well, he's very charismatic, you know, so that never hurts. But the part where I feel like it doesn't necessarily play fair is we had Kathleen's point of view earlier in the book. And so the only way I can make it work is she didn't know that Kier Gray was her father. But I don't think the book is saying that either.
She didn't know. There's no way she could have known.
Yeah, but I feel like she did know. She couldn't have for the book to still work. Yeah, because she definitely didn't know. No, she definitely didn't know. But in the sequel, she did. So that's weird.
And he is, let's say, you know, at the beginning, you have no way of, you don't know that he's her father, but he does act as a father figure to her. They do have that kind of relationship.
And he's got these famously great mental shields, right, that keep her from reading his mind. So I think I have to assume she didn't know until he had revived her.
Right.
And so then, you know, we have found out while he was on Mars that the tenderless Slans are creating an armada and are going to come to Earth and deal with the problem of humans and true Slans and become the overlords of Earth. But none of that happens in this book. he finds out when it's going to happen. He meets Kier Gray. Kier Gray says, okay, we got a lot of work to do. Let's do it. And by the way,
Yeah.
Here's my daughter, Kathleen.
And the book ends.
And the book ends.
Yeah.
So if you're looking for a book that has a definitive ending, this is not it. I think he had, you know, A. E. Van Vogt had planned on perhaps writing a sequel. There were some notes that were eventually picked up with the permission of his wife.
Yeah.
And turned into another novel called Slant Hunter. I don't remember when it came out. I actually just listened to the audiobook. It's quite entertaining, actually. Okay. I enjoyed it. And yeah. It continues the story. Uh-huh. It does emphasize some of the stuff I just noticed when I was skimming back through the book today. That it does say, you know, in terms of my gripes about there being no radar and what's the level of the technology here, you know, this very retro future. But the reason it's retro future is because civilization has fallen more than once. It's been more than 1,000 years since the first Slan Wars. And so it makes sense that a lot of this information would have gotten lost.
And we've got bits and pieces of information. We have bits and pieces of technology.
Yeah.
Likely nobody knows how to fix any of this stuff. And when it breaks, that's it.
Oh, but it doesn't break because it was made by Slans.
Good thing it doesn't break because no one knows how to fix it.
Yes, exactly. But no, I enjoyed Slant Hunter. I thought it was interesting. And certainly it has the feel of something that was made from notes, because there's a lot of detailed stuff about the origin of the Slans that I'm sure that A. E. Van Vogt had written down but didn't put in this book. You know, I mentioned earlier that the female characters, I feel like, are treated reasonably well here. There's not a lot of them, but, you know, there's kind of two main female, actually three if you count Granny, because you have Joanna, Kathleen, and you have Granny.
I don't know if I count Joanna, because she's just in the story so little.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I mean, she's just fine. We just, she doesn't have a lot of page time, where true. We get a lot of time with Granny, we get a lot of time with Kathleen.
But then she is a little bit fridged, you know, when she's killed off.
Yeah.
The parts where she was in the book, I thought, yeah. Okay, she's cool. You know, I can't wait to follow her the rest of the book, you know, because she's kind of badass and that's awesome. And then, oh, okay, she's dead. Dang it.
Maybe she just died so fast that I didn't quite accept it.
Maybe. Yeah. But, you know, I feel like we could have had, you know, I object sometimes to the thing where it's like, okay, Jami's mom is still alive. His dad was this great scientist. Yeah. And now mom is just trying to keep Jami alive long enough so that he can go and follow up on his father's research. I'm like, well, I mean, you're a Slan as well. Can you not follow up on the research? But I know that, you know, geniuses are geniuses in different things, right? There could have been some ink spilled to explain that, you know, she wasn't the scientist that he was. Okay, fine.
And it's if his mom could follow up on everything, we wouldn't have a story.
No, we wouldn't. It's so the story can happen. Right. Yeah.
So yeah. I mean, mom's a plot device.
Yes. Yeah. She is. I think that's about all I have. I didn't come across anything else in my notes that said where the major differences were. I think it was mostly in that kind of establishing part, where it was establishing Jem Laurie as a jerk.
Yeah.
And I didn't want the distraction of Davy Dinsmore also.
Can't have jerks.
that name Dinsmore reminds me of, I grew up on Danny Kaye. My parents showed us Danny Kaye movies.
Yes.
And Danny Kaye had a variety show at some point. And there's an episode where he has Lucille Ball on. And it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen, where they're these two working class people at a fancy restaurant. And her name, and trying to, you know, looking at, oh, it's been a long time since I've had Philip Mignon. You know? but he calls her Mrs. Din, or Miss Dinsmore. And so
that reminds me of it. I got to find that on YouTube.
Yeah, oh, it's the greatest. There's because they're two very funny people, and at some point you can see Danny Kaye come this close to losing it, and then he recovers.
So much. I love it. I love it when two comedians are trying to get the other person to lose it. That is my favorite.
Yeah. Anything else? Anything else you wanted to talk about this book? Themes, plot points, anything we missed?
It was a lot better than I expected, and just thanks for pulling me in and suggesting this book. And I had a really great time reading it.
Me too. I enjoyed it. I recommend it. And it's also quite short. We mentioned, right? It could stand to probably be a little longer, but
it's
I didn't mind.
It's one of these classic 192 page
books. Yes. The kind of book I could easily read on an airplane flight.
Yes.
So so I think that about wraps it up in terms of final thoughts. So where can people find you?
I am mostly on Twitter these days until until it crashes and burns.
Yeah.
But I'm at redhead5318.
Nice. Cool. And then do you have a separate Twitter for Retro Rockets?
I do. It is at Retro Rockets Pod. And we are on Podbean. So if you find me on Twitter, right in my profile is a link to the Retro Rockets Twitter.
Nice. And I'll definitely recommend people listen to the podcast, first of all, just in general. The episode just about Vintage Science Fiction Month was awesome. I thought that was so great. And just, you know, I didn't know anything about it and thought, oh, this is very cool. These are my people.
We have a lot of fun.
So,
those episodes are so much fun to read.
Yeah. Well, Andrea, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you again.
Thank you, Seth.
Yeah. I'm sure we'll talk again. Bye.
Yes.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky.